It's time for the Plan Strong Financial Forum, your weekly hot topic update from a leading Boston area investment advisor. It's smart investing simplified. Now here's your host, Ken Carberry, with the president of Plan Strong Investment Management, Paul Parson.
And welcome to the Plan Strong Financial Forum. I'm your host, attorney Ken Carberry, along with financial advisor Paul Parsons. And Paul, here we are. We're wrapping up summer.
I know.
I'm sorry to bring it up.
But it's so true.
I know. This is really the last weekend of August.
It is. Yeah. It's true. But, and you know what? A good week of weather.
Yes.
Good weekend.
That's right.
Of weather.
We'll take it.
Well, in New England, especially, right? You know, as opposed to, say, off the coast of Sicily.
Yeah.
How about that? That freak storm. I'll talk about that.
Horrible tragedy.
Oh my goodness. When you can capsize, you know, almost a 200-foot boat. That tells you that's a bad
storm. That's a bad storm. Yikes. So, yeah, we'll cover that later on.
Yeah.
So, you have a lot of things to talk about, though. Here we are at the end of summer.
Yeah. Well, actually, one or two that are associated with economics and markets and all kinds of stuff.
Which is why we're here.
So, well, why don't we start with what we're going to talk about
today? Yeah, all right.
I'm going to start. I'm going to lead off with, you know, this first look of August economic activity.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? And specifically, are we going towards recession? Because you may recall, at the beginning of August, the market had a mini conniption.
It certainly did.
Over concerns that growth, economic growth, was stalling.
Right.
And as a result, oh my God, the sky is falling and sell, sell, sell. Well, people didn't sell that much. It was down. Market was down 3% that day. But a lot of people got, you know, themselves all worked up and exercised over it. So it certainly raised a lot of questions with people. And the market had been on a downswing for a couple weeks prior to that.
Right.
And probably one of the reasons, because the market had been on an upswing almost uninterrupted for an awful long time before that. Right. But anyway, the question du jour, and certainly for, or should I say de la semaine for this week.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
Is, you know, the latest data, does it say we're going into recession or not? And and most importantly, we got the PMI flash, which is for the current month. So it's really current. It's not like GDP, which is, you know, a quarter old. This is actually current data for the month of August. And we're still in August, albeit at the end of August, but we're still in August.
Okay.
And it's a good measurement of how's economic activity look. So I got to cover that first.
Okay.
And then there was a news story this week that most people heard about, with the exception of maybe the Secretary of Commerce. And that's another one of my discussion points I'm going to talk about in the middle minute. And that is, do the labor market revisions that just came out, do they mean bad things or not? And unfortunately, our Secretary of Commerce was unaware of those. But we'll cover that shortly, because after all, you know, it's not her department. That's Department of Labor.
Well,
okay,
there you go.
She's Secretary of Commerce. But
we were aware of them.
Well, you would think, you know, if you got a bachelor's in economics, magna cum laude from Harvard, and then you went to Oxford, and then after Oxford, you went to Yale Law School, and then you were the Secretary of Commerce.
Yeah.
Maybe you would have picked up on that one.
Right. And it wasn't a small revision.
No, it was one of the it was the biggest revision since 2009.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would say that's not small.
Right.
So anyway, we did get labor market revisions, and the question was, what does it mean? And how should investors interpret that? Then I wanted to talk about something that I think some people have started to notice, which is that stocks have almost completely recovered to their all-time highs. The S&P is within 1% of the all-time high it hit on July 16th.
Okay.
So we're awfully close at, you know, between 25 and 2600. We're, you know, we're getting really close to where it was. Okay. And yet bonds and bond yields haven't recovered to where they were. So the question is, why is there this disconnect between what has happened to stocks since this, with this recovery, versus why have bond yields not recovered in the same period of time? So I want to talk about that and what the implication is to that. I know it sounds a little inside baseball, but it's actually a lot more important than even I'm making it sound right now.
Okay. All
right. Then I wanted to talk about looking beyond our nose here. So looking beyond, say, you know, the next 3 to 6 months. I want to look out a little bit to say, what are some longer term economic trends that investors should worry about? Because there is one in particular that I'm looking at and saying, yikes, all of these things that we're noticing could really pour into one result and something that investors should protect their portfolio against. So four or five things that are really, I think, contributing to the possibility of this happening. So important for investors to hear about that from a more longer term investing perspective. And then it wouldn't be Paul and Ken if we didn't talk about an update in the weight loss drug market, because there were two big stories this week that came out on that. So have to hit that. And you know what, Kenny? You know I'm not the biggest fan of for investors in EVs in the United States, simply because I think it's a really tough business. And if you will, demand to some degree has been stoked by government programs, by policy, not necessarily by, you know, organic demand. And therefore, you live and die by, you know, political pluses and minuses and how, you know, the support or lack of support for these kinds of initiatives. Well, there were a couple of important stories this week about continued challenges for U.S. EV makers. And so, you know, I'm not a big fan of the auto industry anyway. It's kind of like the food industry, that, you know, the margin traditionally are very, very tight, and it's a really tough market, a tough place to make a living. But it's especially tough now for United States electric vehicle makers. So I want to hit that. And if we have a little time at the end, I have a very short story about the fact that gold has hit a new all-time high.
In fact,
gold is up 20% year-to-date. So I would say that's a pretty good year.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
Okay.
All right. Want to get started?
No. Yes. Yes, I do. Okay. You know what? I want to start, though, first with that story I alluded to about the weather.
Sure.
And that UK-based super yacht that's called Baysian that sank off the coast of Sicily this past Monday before dawn in a violent storm that produced a waterspout, essentially a tornado over the water. You know, I've seen waterspouts before in Florida. You don't get worried about it much, but this was a big water spout and really a problem. And there's actual video. Did you see the video?
No, I did not.
There's an actual video from another yacht that shows this huge sailboat's mast that's all lit up. It shows it, it keeps showing it, and then it's not there anymore. And you say, oh, boy, that's not good. And you think about it. The mast of the sailboat was over 180 feet long. You know how long the mast was? 240 feet high.
Oh, my.
Okay? And so it was the tallest aluminum mast ever made in the world on a mega yacht. So this thing is huge. But the problem is when you have that much surface area and those kinds of hurricane force winds, well, you know what happened? It caused the mast to actually lever the boat to become flat in the water. In other words, go over on its side.
Sure.
And do you know what? It's been hot in Sicily. So, you know, the people that were asleep down below, they had their portal windows open.
And the water
just came in. It sank in less than 2 minutes. And unlike a whole bunch of other yachts around them, this boat was at anchor rather than, you know, anytime you get into a storm, I guess, and I'm not a big boater at all, but I know enough that if bad weather's coming, the worst thing you can do is go broadside. You want to keep your bow into the bad weather. Well, nobody did that. This thing was at anchor, and so this thing hit it broadside and was able to essentially knock it down. And as a result, 7 people out of 22 died, including, now talk about a bad week, this British tech tycoon, Mike Lynch, who a lot of people in the UK consider to be kind of like the Bill Gates of the United Kingdom, right? He's this incredible entrepreneur who was a software guy and he made a lot of dough doing it. Well, he and his 18-year-old daughter were lost as part of this. And the reason he was celebrating with his family on this mega yacht that he owned was his recent acquittal of charges by U.S. authorities of fraud after selling his company to Hewlett-Packard. And by the way, after he had won that case, at the same time, his daughter was celebrating about her beginning to start college at Oxford. Okay,
That's a sad story, Paul.
Incredible, right? But talk about bad timing. Lynch had been under house arrest during his trial for a bunch of months during this past year, and he was finally celebrating freedom following his acquittal. And you know what? Another weird thing that happened associated with this whole thing? There was another twist of fate where one of the other co-defendants, it was actually Lynch's VP of finance, was killed a few days prior to the sinking of the yacht when he was struck by a car in a freak accident while jogging near his home in the United Kingdom. And you just say,
really?
This is bad karma.
In the same week.
In the same week. Isn't that amazing?
That's a strange story. All right.
Yeah.
Let's get started with, this other strange story.
Which are going to be a lot better. More positive.
The latest data for economic activity, as you mentioned, we have some data just starting off to give us an inkling of what's happening in August. So are we headed towards a recession?
Well, the good news is I didn't tell that human interest story to set up the fact that this was, you know, another sinking coming.
Okay, good.
In fact, I wanted to do it, though, reminding our listeners that the whole market freakout that happened at the beginning of this month was primarily related to economic growth scares. And that was really fueled, if you will, by the July jobs report that reflected slowing hiring, along with some good but not great revenue guidance for some of the mega tech stocks. Remember we said they're priced for perfection and anything less than perfection and terrific guidance, the market's going to say, oh, that's not good enough and we're going to sell. And sure enough, that happened to a degree following July 16th. But since then, stocks have bounced back after strong retail sales and weaker than expected inflation data really helped alleviate recession fears. And it appears that investors have pivoted away from those growth scares and are actually back focused on the Fed's rate cutting plan. So that's what everybody's focused on right now is the Fed. Well, in fact, one last thing before we go to break, Ken, the S&P right now, the S&P 500 is now within 1% of its all-time high hit on July 16th, right? And literally value stocks have completely recovered and growth stocks even are back to within a couple of percent of their value at the peak. And the only thing I'd say is the forward multiple is also back very close to its peak. It's at 21.4 times earnings, down slightly from 21.8 times, but still very, very rich, which reflects returned optimism for growth. So when we come back, I'm going to answer the question, is the optimism of the market warranted?
That's coming up. It's the Plan Strong Financial Forum.
This is Paul Parsons, president of Plan Strong Investment Management, and you're listening to the Plan Strong Financial Forum. If you like what you hear on our show and want me to take a look at your investments and retirement plan, call my office at 888-972-7526, 888-972-7526. That's 888-972-PLAN. Or go to planstrong.com.
Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network, member FINRA, SIPC. A registered investment advisor, 980 Washington Street, Dedham, Mass.
From the Plan Strong broadcast studios at the epicenter of capitalism, this is the Plan Strong Financial Forum with Paul Parsons, president of Plan Strong Investment Management.
And welcome back to the Plan Strong Financial Forum. I'm your host, attorney Ken Carberry, along with financial advisor Paul Parsons. And Paul, we mentioned at the beginning of the program, this is it, the last weekend of August.
The last hurrah.
I know. Anything planned for the weekend?
Going to Chatham, play a little golf, have a nice time, and certainly watching some golf.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, you know, are you watching these golf tournaments now towards the end of the season?
My grandson loves them, so I've had to watch more than I ordinarily would.
I hear you. Well, just so you know, because I'll fill you in so you can know what your grandson's so excited about, okay? This is the second leg for the top golfers in the world. It's called the BMW Championships now. So it's the whole FedEx Cup playoffs. It's three tournaments, okay? It's a three event schedule. The first event has 70 players. That was last week. That was in Memphis. That was the St. Jude, okay? This now, of those 70, the top 50, then proceed on to the next tournament, which is this weekend, which is in being played in Colorado.
Okay,
just outside of Denver. So it's the top 50 there. The 30 survivors from that, so it goes 70, 50, 30. In week three, the top 30 then finally play at Eastlake in Atlanta for the big prize, which is the FedEx Tour Championship. And do you know how much the winner gets?
No.
25 large. That's not 25,000. That's $25 million.
That's a nice prize.
Okay. That's incentive. Okay.
Yes,
to win.
It is.
And by the way, you know who are leading the pack right now?
Yeah.
Two Americans.
Oh, there you go. Scotty, I'm guessing.
Scotty's number one.
Right.
And Xander Schauffele's number two. How's that for a deal, right? So Scheffler and Schauffele are one and two in the standings at this point. And you know what I'll be doing late in the afternoon on, you know, Friday, Saturday,
watching
Sunday.
Some golf.
Absolutely right.
With a beverage, perhaps.
Perhaps.
A cold beverage.
Yeah,
it'll be very nice.
You never know.
One never knows. All right, so we're talking about optimism, speaking of looking forward to something. It seems like there's optimism. Is it warranted in the market?
Yeah, you know, as you were saying very nicely, the question is the optimism in the market warranted by the underlying economy?
Yeah.
What are the actual numbers saying? And this week, there was some new, very fresh data released about the current state of growth in the U.S. economy. In fact, just a day or two ago, the market PMI, manufacturing and services data was released for August, our current month.
Yeah.
And it reflects continued solid economic expansion overall this month, driven by growth in services businesses, while manufacturing activity continues to slightly contract. But don't forget, services is much more important than manufacturing overall. And the overall composite reading was 54.1 in August. It was down from 55.0 in July, but the economic report really reinforces the fact that this thing is solidly growing. And as a result, it reinforces the stock market's hope that growth scares from early in the month were unfounded. And I just wanted to mention one other thing, a little bit of inside baseball on these reports, but it's important maybe to mention this. And that is, the market survey is one of two used nationwide by economists. And it frankly, I think it's probably the better measure for us to be looking at right now, because it weights forward-looking components more highly than past contributors, while the other survey uses a straight average of its five components. And the market survey polls a mix of company sizes, where the other survey focuses just on large multinationals. And the market survey reports activity in the U.S. only, while the other survey includes economic activity of companies that are headquartered in the U.S., but produce stuff overseas. They count all that activity, not just the activity in the U.S.
Right.
So I actually like this metric as it relates to what we're looking for right now, which is how healthy is the economy looking going forward, okay? And how broadly is it looking good going forward? So, and what I'd conclude essentially is, so far, the latest, the most current economic data is strong enough to say we are nowhere near recessionary levels, at least not yet. And we're not trending hard in that direction.
Okay.
And the stock market views that news positively and has incorporated a lot of that.
So, and while we're talking about the economic data, there was obviously a big story. We alluded to it earlier this week that there was a large downward adjustment in the past year's job ads. And we see these adjustments often, pretty much every time there's an adjustment.
That's
sometimes
right.
Up, sometimes down. It seems like lately we've had a few down, and this was a big movement in the downward direction, in the wrong direction, right?
Correct.
So tell us about that. What does that mean?
Okay, so there was, just again, giving background, there was a data point released this past week that really pointed, and this is why so many people were worried about it, pointed to lower economic growth overall in the economy. And it was associated with employment over the past year through the end of Q1. So this is not through June. This is through March.
Okay.
Good point. Have to recognize it's for the last year. And it's saying, what's the health of the employment market over the last year ending at the end of Q1?
Right.
Okay. And again, let me just give you a little bit more background here. A lot of longer term investors know that the monthly jobs report produced by the Bureau of Labor Statistics in the Department of Labor is a somewhat inaccurate estimation that's prone to sometimes large monthly revisions. So we see those revisions almost every month, okay? But it's the best measure of national jobs growth we have, so we just have to accept it, essentially warts and all. Now, the good news is that the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, knows how inaccurate it is. So not only do they revise it monthly, and we talk about those, but they also annually, they revise a previous 12 months of data to make sure, hey, is the whole thing right, or does the whole thing need to be adjusted a bit? And guess what? This is the annual adjustment. And this week they did that, and for the period of April 23 to March of 24. And normally it isn't a huge deal because the adjustments are relatively small. But given the sensitivity of the market right now to any signs of economic deterioration, there was a lot of eyes were on this report, right? So sure enough, it was reported that the U.S. economy created 800,000 fewer jobs than the 2.9 million originally reported over that 12-month period.
A big, big chunk, right?
30% less.
Okay. That's a big chunk,
And that's the largest revision since 2009. Big, big revision.
Right.
And that means monthly job gains of 175,000 per month instead of the closer to 240, 250 that was initially reported. So the jobs market essentially wasn't as strong as originally reported, meaning it was more average than thought. It wasn't terrible. It was just more average. But, you know, we were under the impression at 240, 250,000 jobs a month, that's pretty strong.
Right.
Well, it was more meh than strong. And as a result, that could provide further incentive, frankly, for the Fed to start lowering rates in September because the concern is the economy not as strong? Okay. Well, this week, the other thing that happened was we got the July FOMC meeting minutes, so the Fed meeting minutes from the end of July, and they were released in which several Fed officials acknowledged there was, quote, plausible cause for lowering borrowing costs and a, quote, vast majority considered a September move as likely appropriate. So they're sending out the smoke signals, folks. And there were even some who wanted to consider a move before September, a cut before September, citing concerns about labor market deterioration. And they knew probably that these adjustments were coming. And also a less optimistic outlook for economic growth in the second half of 2024 that the Fed actually provided. So they knew, they were worried that their things are slowing down a bit, even more than what had been published at that time. So with all of that information between what happened with the FOMC meeting minutes and the downgrading, if you will, of the amount of jobs that were added from late 2023 and the first quarter of 2024, essentially what we've seen now is Fed funds futures reflect an increasing likelihood of interest rate cuts coming soon. In fact, current Fed funds rates reflect a 100% chance of a rate cut in September. And there's actually a 36% probability of two rate cuts in that same time frame, just in September. And the interest rate futures market is also predicting a better than three-quarters chance of rates going down by a full percentage point by the end of 2024.
Wow.
So the overnight rate today is 5.25 to 5.5. Interest rate futures markets are saying we're going to end the year at 4.25 to 4.5. Okay,
that's a big drop.
And I will say one last thing that the Fed meeting minutes fueled this expectation of rate cuts, and the downward jobs report revisions only increased the probability of more rate cuts sooner. And that news, frankly, was welcomed by the stock market, and that's why we saw the stock market continue to do well.
All right. A lot of information there, Paul.
There is.
When we come back, let's talk about this other issue that we talked about at the beginning of the program. Stocks have almost completely rebounded from earlier in the month.
Right.
But bond yields have not.
Yeah.
And so how should investors interpret that? What does that mean for investors? And what are the markets trying to tell us? You're going to tell us all of that when we return.
I hope so.
It's the Plan Strong Financial Forum.
This is Paul Parsons, president of Plan Strong Investment Management, and you're listening to the Plan Strong Financial Forum. If you like what you hear on our show and want me to take a look at your investments and retirement plan, call my office at 888-972-7526, 888-972-7526. That's 888-972-PLAN. Or go to planstrong.com.
Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network, member FINRA, SIPC. A registered investment advisor. 980 Washington Street, Dedham, Mass.
Who says financial talk can't be exciting and informative? Well, at least it's informative. It's the Plan Strong Financial Forum with Paul Parsons, president of Plan Strong Investment Management.
And welcome back to the Plan Strong Financial Forum. I'm your host, attorney Ken Carberry, along with financial advisor Paul Parsons. And Paul, we had that story about the revision of the labor stats. And of course, a very big story. The market responded and politicians discussed it. But one prominent politician didn't notice that it had happened. You had mentioned this at the beginning of the show. Our former local governor, Gina Raimondo, I guess she didn't believe it.
Yeah, well, I think that's right.
Even more than not knowing it, she did not believe it.
And it came from a, best of all, an ABC anchor telling her.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like, you know, some, you know, Peter Ducey from Fox News telling her.
Right.
It was ABC News.
Yeah.
And so for those of you that didn't hear this story, I really found it hard to believe because our U.S. Commerce Secretary essentially, you know, this is like when I miss a 2-foot putt. I say to my friends, I didn't cover myself in glory on that one.
Right, yeah.
This is one of those where she did not cover herself in glory.
Right.
Because she was asked by an ABC reporter about the downward revision to the jobs added in the U.S. over the last year by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, right? And after, and she answered it by saying that Trump had said that the statistic and that he has never said anything truthful, so she didn't pay any attention to it. The ABC anchor corrected her and said that the report came from Raimondo's own government. And as a result, then Raimondo just replied, well, I'm not familiar with that, quote unquote. And I have to tell you, I don't know what to say to that.
When that's a tough one, yeah.
The Secretary of Commerce doesn't know that the number of jobs added in the last year was, you know, marked down by a third, essentially.
Right.
That's
a big story.
I would say that's a big story.
And she's very bright and very accomplished.
Yeah. I mean, listen, Harvard, Oxford student, and Yale Law School. I thought she was a pretty smart lady, but... you know, maybe it's just a little cocktail time at the DNC, and so you don't have time to look at the Wall Street Journal or something. But you'd think that would come up pretty early in the prep with their staff.
Yeah, and you know, I suppose part of it too, Paul, is everything's politics. She's at the DNC, so rather than answering anything straight, she's trying to politic her way out of it rather than just saying, well, we'll, you know, sometimes these revisions happen. And I mean, usually there's a line they have to answer those kinds
of things.
Anything
rather than I'm not aware of it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, that's not the answer you want to give.
Right.
Okay. But you know what? You and I were talking off air also. I just thought of this. I understand that it's your dear wife's birthday coming.
Yeah, a couple of months. Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's a big one, too. I can't say which one on the radio, but it's a big one.
It's a large one. An El Grande one.
It is,
well,
it is.
I have a suggestion for those people, including you, looking for the ultimate jewelry gift for a loved one. Okay.
Okay.
And I hope Mary's listening to this because this could set expectations. Okay.
All right.
You ready?
Yeah.
Bloomberg reports that a massive, almost 2,500 carat diamond has been recovered from a mine in Botswana.
Perfect.
So you know where Botswana is, South Central Africa, right? It's way down there. This is the second largest stone ever unearthed, Kenny. So this would make an impression on Mary. I'm pretty sure. It's second only to the 3,100 plus carat Cullinan diamond, which was discovered in South Africa almost 120 years ago.
Wow.
I'm telling you, even though it's number two, it's the biggest thing to come out of the ground in 120 years.
Not bad.
Okay? She would be impressed with this. Just to give you an idea of size, the stone fully fits in an outstretched adult hand.
That's a big diamond.
It's a big boy. Yeah. It's like if it was more round, it would be the size of a softball.
Okay. Yeah.
So I don't know how you wear that. Yeah. You know, maybe.
I'm sure she'll figure it out.
Well, Flavor Flav could do something,
that's
right? Dangle it from your neck or something. But whatever, it's really quite something. This latest discovery was made by Canada's Lucara Diamond Corps and was the beneficiary of using X-ray technology to identify high-value stones in the primary ore body without actually breaking them. Mm. You know, because in the past, trying to separate brittle stones from hundreds of tons of waste rock would often lead to not extracting the full stone intact.
Right.
You know, you say to yourself, wow, that's fantastic. And then the next question is, well, what's this going to set me back? If you, Kenny, decide to go buy this thing?
Yes, yes.
Well, I have some good news. The good news is they haven't done a full assessment yet of the quality of the gem. So they don't have a valuation for it.
Good.
But some stones, not nearly as large in the past, would indicate a value in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Oh, okay.
So
good.
Maybe you may have to crack into that piggy bank a little deeper.
Yeah,
okay?
I guess I'll have my friend Elon pick it up for me.
There you go.
All right, Paul, so we mentioned the fact that stocks have just about completely rebounded, but bond yields haven't. So what does that mean for investors?
So the reason that this is important, I know it sounds like inside baseball, but it's not. It's actually a really important point for investors to understand. So, again, a little background. Leading up to the washout in stocks that we had on August 5th, we essentially had the S&P 500, the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield, and also the dollar yen all moving in the same direction. They were all going down. Their prices were all going down, okay? But since then, the S&P has almost completely recovered, but the 10-year Treasury yield and the Japanese yen we've seen them both bounce back a bit, but then it stalled, and now it remains at or near those August 5th lows.
Hmm.
So the question is, wait, why did the stocks recover essentially all the way back, but bonds and the yen, or the dollar against the yen, went the other way? What happened to that? And the answer is there are actually two ways to interpret this, okay? The positive view is that the stock market is pricing in a perfectly executed soft landing by the Fed, where they cut aggressively enough to push the entire yield curve and the dollar lower, thereby relieving stress on consumers and corporations and boosting profits at the same time for U.S. companies producing overseas. Essentially, the stock market is viewing falling yields and the weakening dollar as virtuous for earnings and growth. It's happening for the right reason. Remember how we talked about that in the back?
Yeah,
past?
That's the positive answer.
Here's the negative view. Uh-oh. The negative view is that the declines in Treasury yields and the dollar are forecasting a much more aggressive rate cut stance by the Fed. And here's the key, because growth is slowing dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they have to cut them because they're worried that the economy is going to go into a recession. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean an automatic recession, but it does mean that stocks are grossly exposed to another more long-lasting growth scare. And that's a problem with them, given the fact that they're back near all-time highs. They're further to fall again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So simply put, stocks are ignoring any economic warning signs and solely focused on the Fed sticking the soft landing, while bonds and the dollar are telling us growth is slower than we think or want.
Okay.
That's what it's saying.
So what do you think?
Well, time's going to tell which one is right. At least historically, the bond market, the pessimistic one, tends to be right. And there's extra risk in the way the stock market views things right now because stock valuations are so stretched. And that reflects that investors don't appreciate the economic risks building in the economy.
Mm-hmm.
What should investors do? Well, my personal take and what we're doing at Plan Strong is planning for bear and hoping for bunny.
Okay.
Okay. Which means prepare your portfolio to take advantage of upside, but protect against meaningful downside. And if you don't know how to do this, call my office for help.
Yeah. Paul's toll free number is 888-972-7526, 888-972-PLAN. And just ask about how to do that. that, how to protect against the downside while experiencing some of the upside.
Yeah.
All right, Paul, let's talk a little bit about the outlook beyond just today or just this year. So what's one longer-term major economic theme that you think investors should know about?
Well, there are a number of policy trends that we're seeing that are very likely to continue. And there's a real worry, Ken, that many of these trends will cause an economic results that investors need to prepare for. So let's talk about what those policy things are.
Mm-hmm.
First, we know that there's a real appetite for deglobalization since the COVID supply chain interruptions. That was a disaster,
sure.
Right? And what does that mean? It means onshoring. And nearshoring and home shoring and any other kind of shoring you can think of. And there is a reason that most of that activity had been offshored in the first place. You know what it was? Lower cost.
Yeah.
So if the corollary is likely that it will likely make costs go up or be inflationary if you onshore it or nearshore it or anything other short mm-hmm. other than offshore.
Okay.
So that looks inflationary, this whole move of deglobalizing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The second thing that we're seeing is energy transition. And that's a significant policy and an investment theme that's out there right now and implies significant costs to implement without improving economics. Anybody that doesn't believe that, take a look at your Massachusetts electric bill.
No kidding.
And
yeah.
California,
yeah.
And compare that to other parts of the country that aren't investing in that.
Mm-hmm.
So this energy transition thing is increasing costs, but you're still using the same amount of energy.
Sure.
Okay? It just costs you more. And what that means is higher ongoing costs. Otherwise, capitalism would have promoted it for its economic benefit. So energy transition is also going to be inflationary. And if, as I said, if you don't believe it, just look at the electricity costs around the country.
Yeah, right.
Okay?
No, I've noticed.
Okay. Third one, we are likely to see more military spending. And that diverts capital from other productive uses that create economic benefits over a long period of time. For example, if you build a factory,
mm-hmm.
that produces more stuff, right?
Sure.
And it creates more economic activity. You build a weapon, you fire the weapon, that's it. It's over.
Yeah, good point.
You get
yeah.
one and done,
mm-hmm.
okay? So what it does is it takes capital away. And it's more for one-time use. What does that do? Essentially leads to more inflation again. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Fourth, we could see more restrictions on immigration as opposed to very few today. And that could lead to higher labor costs and inflation.
Okay.
And finally, the expansion of this whole social safety net to include extremely costly items like housing and health care and child care and education, all of that can lead to inflation if the government doesn't offset other costs to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope you're getting the theme
yeah.
here. All of these trends are leading to more inflation. And that is a major risk in the next 3 to 5 years. And that likely means that interest rates will likely be higher than they were in the last 15 years. It also means that investors should make sure they have holdings that increase in value with inflation rather than losing purchasing power. For example, like with cash.
Mm-hmm.
Cash, you lose purchasing power. What we're saying is, if inflation really is going to become a problem, you need to make sure you have more of your assets in what are called real assets or assets that grow with inflation.
When we come back, a couple of stories about the weight loss drug market and more challenges for U.S. automakers in the EV market. That's when we return. It's PlanStrong Financial Forum.
This is Paul Parsons, president of PlanStrong Investment Management, and you're listening to the PlanStrong Financial Forum. If you like what you hear on our show and want me to take a look at your investments and retirement plan, call my office at 888-972-7526, 888-972-7526. That's 888-972-PLAN. Or go to PlanStrong.com.
Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network, member FINRA, SIPC. A registered investment advisor, 980 Washington Street, Dedham, Mass.
Finally, a radio show that is not trying to sell you insurance or annuities. This is the Plan Strong Financial Forum with Paul Parsons, president of Plan Strong Investment Management.
And welcome back to the Plan Strong Financial Forum. I'm your host, Attorney Ken Carberry, along with financial advisor Paul Parsons. And Paul, of course, we had a busy week. I'm sure you were glued to the television set watching the DNC.
I've watched the DNC as much as I watch the RNC. Yeah. How's that?
Same here.
Yeah. I gave it the amount of time it deserved. Yeah, How's that? But you have to laugh at these things because this is just kabuki theater, you know? Yeah. So anyway, I have to tell you, what'd you think of the whole thing?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
you read about it.
Yeah. No, I actually did see a little bit.
I
saw clips. I watched it here and there.
Yeah.
And again, same thing as the Republican, the RNC. I watch it and I laugh or I make fun of them. Yeah. That's kind of what I do until I can't take it anymore.
Did you have any favorites? I had a couple favorites.
Oh no. What do you got?
I have to tell you. All right.
Sure.
Do you mind?
No. Go ahead.
Okay. Michelle Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Telling the story during her remarks that her parents were suspicious of folks who took more than they needed, referring obviously to the wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she lives by that, you know, kind of platitude every day.
Hmm.
You know, forgive me, but I find it a little self-serving, you know, because this is a lady that's wearing a $3,000 pantsuit. And I'm thinking, probably didn't pick that up at Kmart, right? And don't they have a bunch of homes?
Oh,
right?
Sure.
Right?
Yeah,
they have
true.
Four homes. I actually looked up how much they paid for the four homes, not what they're worth today.
Yeah.
$30 million.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. So, and she got a book deal for $70 million.
Yeah, that's
okay.
She probably could have, that may have been more than, do you think that book made $70
million? I doubt it.
Yeah, but, no, I don't think any book makes that money these days.
All I can think to myself is if, you know, really, this you're kind of stretching your credibility on this one. But speaking of stretching credibility,
yeah.
Michelle Obama's Little League compared to Oprah, because Oprah got up there. And that she said that she had seen or been on the receiving end of racism and sexism and division. And my favorite one, income inequality. And I'm thinking
Yikes.
To myself, well, the only income inequality she knows about is her having a lot more than anybody else.
Yeah, she's often been the highest paid entertainer in the country. Yeah.
$2.7 billion.
Ooh,
I mean, I don't know how you complain about that. I mean, it seems like this whole broken American system may have worked okay for her.
Yeah,
right?
I think so.
Just saying for a friend. Okay, either that or I happily will take the 2.7 off your hands.
Sure.
And you can complain all you want. Okay, and then you don't feel as much of a hypocrite. But, you know, and as I said, you know, these are the DNC things. We took our whacks at the RNC ones at the same
time. Plenty to laugh at.
But there was an interesting story that I actually wasn't. Yeah, I'm always looking for palace intrigue.
Okay. Yeah.
And there was speculation as to why Kamala Harris decided to attend a rally in Wisconsin rather than be on site at the convention for the Obama speeches. Because you know the Obama's going to be wildly popular, right? It's going to be a good night. And if they're going to get up there and all they're going to do is sing your praises, I mean, who wouldn't mind just sitting back and just taking the act?
Exactly.
Right, letting them flow over you, wash over you. But there was conjecture that Harris had decided to not attend the Obamas' glowing words because of the rift between the Obamas and her current employer, a Joe Biden.
Oh, right.
And the reason for that is Biden is apparently very angry that the Obamas forced him out, and Harris has to work with Biden for the remainder of his term.
Mm-hmm.
So she decided to distance herself from the Obamas to keep the peace with her boss.
Oh, okay. I like that story. That does a little bit of palace intrigue.
Isn't that kind of,
yeah.
And it kind of rings true,
it
too.
It does
right?
make sense.
I mean, why else wouldn't you be there?
Absolutely.
Right? And just one last thing. When I was researching any of these stories, because I didn't see them live, I can tell you that, the censors at Google are working overtime right now protecting the vice president because accessing any of these stories had to be done without any help from the Google search engine. Because if you did that, the only results that came up to any queries related to these topics were incredibly glowing coverage of Harris and the Democrats and the DNC.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, boy, whatever the algorithm it is, if it's anything bad,
right.
You're not going to see it if you go to Google.
There
Just saying that right now, okay?
All right, Paul, speaking of news, there was some news about the weight loss drug market, a couple of big stories, and I know you have a personal interest.
But I do.
Also been following these because there's a lot of money
exactly.
going into those stocks.
Yeah, and there's an investment interest in these, very much so, which we've been talking about now for, it's been 2 years.
Yes,
can you imagine that? 2 years we've been talking about these. And as you know, Kenny, money, the two big kahunas in the weight loss drug sweepstakes are Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk, mm-hmm. right? This week, Lilly announced the results of another study that highlighted the benefits of their weight loss drugs with something unrelated to weight loss. So this time, it was type 2 diabetes.
Right.
And specifically, Lilly found that their weight loss drug Zepbound significantly reduced the risk of type 2 diabetes among people with excess weight and elevated blood sugar levels, also known as pre-diabetic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So when you say to yourself, what's significantly reduced? You know, that sounds like pretty good.
Yeah.
Did they cut it in half or how'd it do? Over a three-year period, weekly injections of Zepbound reduced the progression to type 2 diabetes by 94%.
Wow.
Compared to a placebo.
Really?
I'd say that's pretty successful.
I don't think
you?
Anything works that well.
It's amazing, isn't it? And by the way, at the same time, while it didn't allow these pre-diabetics to become diabetic, mm-hmm. it also led to an average weight loss of 15 to 23%, depending on the dosage of the med, compared to a 2% weight loss for those on the placebo.
Wow.
Can I just say, if I was on that placebo for 3 years and everybody else around he was getting skinny,
right.
You'd know you were on the placebo.
Yeah, I think so.
Right? So
good point.
The other thing I wanted to, a couple other things I wanted to mention about this. First, the finding expands the list of additional health benefits beyond weight loss for this class of anti-obesity drugs. And that list so far includes reducing the risk of heart attack and strokes. That's a big one.
Mm-hmm.
Also, easing the severity of sleep apnea.
Really?
Absolutely.
Wow.
And this growing list of benefits, frankly, could boost sales for drug makers and also convince insurers and employers to pay up for the expensive medicine.
Uh-huh.
So that should
sure.
increase demand for these as well. And speaking of sales, Lilly's sales of diabetes and weight loss drugs, Mounjaro and Zepbound, are becoming a key factor in recent performance of the stock, fueling substantial earnings and revenue growth. So far, year-to-date, Lilly stock price is up 64% after being up 61% in 2023.
Couple of good years.
Let's just say they're ahead of the market in both years.
Absolutely. Okay, that's one story. You have another one.
Well, the Journal had a Herd on the Street column also about a big pharma name that had not yet really approached the weight loss drug market, but had a really strong record of growth. And the good news is that it isn't trading. This stock, is its price doesn't incorporate an elevated multiple like Lilly and Novo Nordisk, mm-hmm. at least not yet. So the article talks about cancer drug maker leader AstraZeneca and its impressive revenue growth over the past decade related to essentially cancer-related drugs. And in the coming months, AstraZeneca is going to be releasing key data from an early-stage study of a weight loss GLP-1 pill it got as part of an acquisition. So this isn't an injection. This is a pill.
Mm.
But now it looks like they're starting to get into the game, albeit by acquisition, but still getting into the game. And they also have a broad pipeline of drugs making their way through late-stage trials, including some that are targeting large audiences. That's very important because that means big potential revenue markets, including those with lung and breast cancer. And finally, the article concludes that the stock remains one of the best bets in the pharma industry, and potential success in the obesity market isn't yet priced into the stock, with AstraZeneca trading around 19 times forward earnings, while the obesity darlings like Novo Nordisk and Lilly are trading at 30 times plus multiples.
Right.
Okay, big difference.
Absolutely. Paul, quickly, one more story that I really wanted to get to. We've been discussing it for a while now, but there seem to be continued challenges for U.S. automakers who are trying to pivot into the EV market. What's going on there?
And I've tried to provide these warnings over the past year or two, and I know I've sounded like a nervous Nelly, but I think my concerns have really come to light and have come to reality. So let's talk. The first one, I have two stories for you. The first one is non-Chinese automakers are really having a hard time making money in China. And that's important because what was once a gold mine for these global automakers has turned into something else more recently as they've been hit by two things, falling sales and falling prices. And, you know, part of the reason for that is the Chinese buyers have been gravitating more towards homegrown brands like BYD and in a big way. And the global manufacturers that used to dominate these markets like GM and Volkswagen have seen their market shares plummet. But they can't just up and leave the markets either, because if they do, they would be leaving the local providers of parts for these vehicles as well. Mm-hmm. And if they want to make them elsewhere around the world, mm-hmm. well, they're going to need those suppliers. And by the way, it's not just car makers like GM and Volkswagen that are struggling. Tesla has seen their share of revenue from China slip. And Japanese car makers Toyota and Honda have seen their earnings struggle as well. It shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. The Chinese have decided that EVs are the future for their citizens to buy, and they're mandating the demise of the internal combustion engine. They've also said that they want to be the world supplier of EVs. And as a result, this industry is very dear to the future of the People's Republic, and investors of automakers outside the country should expect to be eventually unwelcome. And it appears that day is rapidly approaching, Ken. Mm. And as a result, this is another reason to approach the auto market, and more specifically, the EV market, with caution.
Paul's toll-free number, 888-972-7526, 888-972-PLAN, or you can go online to planstrong.com. Paul, thanks for coming in. Enjoy the last weekend of August on the Cape, and we'll see you next week.
Hope everyone has a wonderful weekend.
It's the Plan Strong Financial Forum.
Plan Strong Investment Management is located at 980 Washington Street, Dedham, Mass., 02026, and can be reached at 888-972-7526. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network, member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor, Paul Parsons representative. This radio show is for informational purposes only and is not a solicitation or recommendation that any particular investor should purchase or sell any particular security. The information contained herein is obtained from sources believed to be reliable, but its accuracy and completeness are not guaranteed. Neither Commonwealth Financial Network nor your representative provides tax advice. Indexes are not managed and do not incur management fees, costs, or expenses, and cannot be invested in directly. Past performance of an index does not guarantee future results. Results.